All right. Let's get fired up here.
Maximum freedom. Read.
Stay on target.
Maximum freedom.
Stay on target.
Maximum freedom. Read Rothbard.
Well, hello and welcome to the Actual Anarchy Podcast. This is the podcast where we talk about movies from a Rothbardian anarcho-capitalist perspective. And tonight we are doing a movie about Cuba and the Cuban Revolution. It could also be a Christmas movie of sorts. It is the Robert Redford movie Havana. And we have, sadly, the guest who suggested this movie and was going to be on with us passed away before he was able to be on with us. And so we're going to do this movie an episode sort of as a tribute to him. He is Robert Wenzel of the economicpolicyjournal.com website and also Target Liberty. It was a daily visit that I would check out his posts, and he did a lot of great work. And he was excited to do this one and also perhaps additional movies in the future. But sadly, that won't be happening. But we hope that we can do it some justice as we review this movie tonight on episode 237 of the show. You can find the show notes more at actualanarchy.com/237. And on that sad note, we will check in with my hetero life mate and co-host. I call him Ivory because he's been on for 99.44% of our episodes. It is Robert Paul Johnson. How you doing there, bud?
What is happening, everyone? Yeah, I'm a little bit. I don't know how to feel about this one. We had a guest that was all lined up to do it, and then sadly couldn't make it. I don't know. Maybe it's good for him. Probably not. But I think I don't know what he would have said about this movie, and I'm missing that. You know, he suggested this movie, right? And you've yes. read some of his stuff. You got some ideas. We got some ideas about economics that maybe we could throw in. But and you've got two posts from his website where he talked about the film, his commentary on it. So we could probably pull from that, but it's just not gonna be the same.
No, certainly not. But I do think that it was going to blow my wad here. But I think that this movie is actually pretty good and is fairly underrated. This is a movie that I had not heard of until recently. And you can't find it available even for sale on streaming services. The only way we could even watch it was on Stars. So we had to subscribe to that to be able to watch this one. I can't even find the logo for it on the internet. So I think it got panned pretty hard and also was a box office failure. But still, I think the quality of the filmmaking is really, really good.
This is fantastic. You have blown your wad early. You've tipped your hand.
That's right.
Now I know your cards. And so then that will allow me to dominate this. I had the exact opposite impression.
Oh,
I said there is a reason why this movie is not widely available, because nobody wants to see this pile of crap. This is Robert Redford's worst performance. Opposite a female lead that has like zero chemistry. I thought that this was a big old fat turd and it deserves to disappear into the toilet bowl of history. I didn't see a whole lot that I enjoyed about it, but we can definitely get into it.
All right. We will duke it out on the last highest portion of the show. And also we are going to have a special guest join us for the Kathleen Turner Overdrive. It is Mike C of Mechanical Dream Revolution. He sides with me on this one. He enjoys this film and has some commentary that he'd like to add. But rather than have him step into the role as guest tonight, we want to hold that seat open for Bob Wenzel. And we will get Mike's commentary during the KTO, which is available for our Patreon supporters. So go to actualanarchy.com/Patreon and people can get a piece of that action. But why don't we ding, ding, ding the bell and we will have a battle royale in the last night's portion of the show, Robert, where we will duke it out and see who is supreme in their analysis of this film.
Fantastic. Can't wait.
Ding, ding, ding. Hey, Hey everyone, it's Daniel Elwood and Robert Paul Johnson. We are the Last Nighters. You can find us at lastnighters.com and also on the Liberty Movement's YouTube channel. This is episode 180 of the show. And it's interesting because we are going to be having 180 degree different opinions on this one, Robert and I. I've already tipped my hand in the pre-show bonus content available for our Patreon supporters. Go to lastnighters.com/Patreon for that, where I've said I enjoyed this film and Robert thinks it is a steaming pile of garbage, or I think he actually said turd. So 180 degree opinion. Now, the other thing I want to mention is that we did have a guest lined up for this. It was Bob Wenzel of Target Liberty and Economic Policy Journal, two great websites with really good content, daily postings and things of that nature. I would go there every day and check out the latest things for his musings on it. And he passed away recently, right after we set up doing this episode with him. And so he is obviously not going to be joining us, but I will try to do my best to present what I thought was some of his analysis of the film from some of the posts that he's made, and also just in general what he has written about over the course of time. He's a big proponent of Austrian economics and a private property society. And he also highlighted that recent events in politics over the last couple of years were like a socialist takeover. He was a supporter of the concept of Hillary over Trump in the 2016 election, not because he liked either one, but because he saw, I think rightly so, that Trump would be a lightning rod for galvanizing the left to coalesce against a common enemy and increase their power and influence and appeal. And I think that was maybe one of the reasons why he wanted to talk about this movie as related to present events going on in the country here. But anyway, before we get into that, let's say hello to my co-host, Robert. Maybe that will perhaps change the color of your analysis of this film. I think you've already said that you don't like it, but hopefully I can sway your opinion a little bit the other way.
I am open to having my mind, but so the idea is having a leftist in charge forever because that pacifies the left. Is that the general thinking?
Related to the 2016, where the Trump versus Hillary, the idea being that Trump was basically an accelerant for leftism, whereas Hillary would have just been a continuation of the Obama cronyism.
Right. But so that's an argument for always having some leftist in charge, or a corporatist, or whatever, some leftist corporate,
or at least somebody who it cannot be demonized as vehemently as a Trump character, because he becomes this big bad boogeyman who basically you have a common enemy, right? And they can all focus their attention on him. Whereas, say, a Mitt Romney or a John McCain, as I think worse than they are than Trump would have been, they wouldn't nearly draw as much ire.
Yeah, I see what your point is. I just, you know, I've always had that big fuck you attitude. And that just seems like a recipe for forever entrenching yourself in the swamp.
Well, it's certainly the creeping
and shake things up.
Yeah, it's certainly the creeping. And I will agree that I think that Trump was far more entertaining. And you know, I remember doing the 2016 election night texting with you and being like, holy crap. You know, and kind of being excited about it, mostly because of the liberal tears and all that. But
And for just the sheer popcorn value.
Right. And you know, Trump, he was an entertaining guy. So we can say that at least we got some comedic value out of it. But I also think that we got a large step towards the socialism being on the menu and being palpable and being acceptable by a large swath of the population. And unfortunately, you know, democracy is, it's the God that failed, as Hans Hermann Hoppe says. And it is really just a tyranny of the majority. And when you get the majority propagandized into these nice sounding surface level, identify a problem and give us the power to solve it politically. And we will, of course, get your vote. And you just get past that first or second layer of thinking and you discover that their solutions are actually just more of the same thing that caused the problem to begin with. But most people don't think one or two steps ahead. And so it's easy to sway them into supporting these things. And we see that as an example in this movie, and I'm sure we'll get into it a little bit. But even Robert Redford in the film is swayed by the rhetoric of the revolutionaries. you know, oh, there's this disparity in the incomes and we all live terribly and it's oppressive and the government is very corrupt. Well, yes, all of these things are true, but that doesn't mean that you go full boat commie because that ends up being actually worse. But as you can see, you know, on the surface level, it's a very sympathetic argument. And we can get into that further after we do the Google description, unless you have any other commentary before I get into that.
No, that's fine. That's fine, Daniel. Let's go. Let's do this.
All right. Ding, ding, ding. We are going to do this. And let me see if I've got the Google description pulled up. I do. All right. Perfect. So tonight we are doing Havana. It is a 1990 film by Sidney Pollack, starring Robert Redford, Alina Olin, Alan Arkin, and the uncredited Raul Julia. So this came out 1990, like I said, 6.1 out of 10 on the IMDb, 28% Rotten Tomatoes, and 85% of Google users like it. The description reads, Jack Weil, played by Robert Redford, is a professional gambler and enjoys the hedonistic lifestyle of Batista's Cuba, where he is organizing a crucial poker game that could make or break him. He meets seductive Bobby Duran, played by Lena Olin, and is surprised that she, a wealthy woman, is aiding Fidel Castro and his communist rebels. Apolitical, Jack doesn't usually take sides, but after Bobby and her husband, Arturo, played by Raul Julia, are arrested, he contemplates risking everything to help their cause. Came out around Christmas, December 12th, 1990, directed by Sidney Pollack, a $40 million budget, and it didn't even break $10 million at the box office, coming in at $9,243,140. And that is the old Google description. Robert, let's get your opening salvo on this one.
The market has spoken about this craptacular, not even slightly entertaining film. You know, you can follow the story. You absolutely can. I wouldn't say at any point that I was engaged with the story, though. It was very much this kind of suave poker player guy who doesn't have a care in the world other than the big score. And then he meets this, quote, super really good looking lady, and that's about it. He wants to help her because she's very attractive, and she kind of plays the damsel in distress role, and that's the only real reason I could see why he was falling for this lady, other than the fact that she was like the other attractive lead in the movie. I didn't see her do anything to endear herself to him. I didn't really see him do anything to endear himself to her other than to be a massive, like, constantly pursuing her, even though she was married. Homewrecker. But this movie was so flat and uninteresting that I was like, it even has a scene, the exact same scene of the ballroom on the final day of Batista Godfather 2 has, right? It's the exact same scene. Except exact same setting, right? It's the final.
Right. Yeah, this is like the prequel. This is like the prequel to Godfather. This is like Godfather 1.5.
Right. So he's down there.
It's Casablanca in Cuba.
Yeah. And I mean, I appreciate that it had Meyer Lansky. I believe it's Lansky. They call him Meyer. I don't know if there's another famous Meyer than Meyer Lansky who's in the mob, who was running gambling and whatnot in Cuba. So
I think he made an appearance in Godfather 2 as well, or a character based on him.
Must have been. Yeah. So I mean, these movies are very much similar. They cover kind of similar territory. I was like, how are you making a boring movie about the Cuban Revolution? It's interesting that they both movies kind of take oh yeah, there's that revolution happening off in the hills, and it's kind of something, and people are kind of talking about it a little bit, but it feels far away. And it doesn't really affect them until it does. And then it's like, oh, this is real and this is happening. And then all of a sudden everything's different. But in this movie, I didn't see why he was really falling for this lady. She was a block of wood, especially her acting was terrible. Robert Redford this is his worst, laziest performance I've ever seen him do. He must have been as equally uninspired by the script as I was. And all the other principals, the general, I forget his name, but the general guy, the Cuban general who's like corrupt or whatever.
The head of the okay police job. Force?
Yeah, the head of the police force. And then the guy who ran the head of the hotel, who I've seen in a million movies.
Alan Arkin.
That guy. He was good. I mean, there were a few good like side characters who were just kind of playing themselves, but they did a pretty good job being kind of character actors that helped those scenes move along. But overall, I thought this movie was just a big long slog that, I mean, I didn't buy the love story, and this is a big love story. And if you don't buy the love story in a love story movie, then it's garbage and falls apart. You need to feel something at the end when he makes the big decision to reunite the husband and wife, and you got to feel for him, like, oh man, he's throwing away the love of his life. And oh, at the end when he still goes back to the beach and he's looking for boats to come in, he's got that hope in his heart. And I was just like, I don't know, I guess this happened. I felt nothing. And so this movie was a big flat zero for me. I mean, it's watchable somewhat, and there's interesting things that we can discuss, like how he, how he's just this carefree kind of gambler guy, and he gets involved with these people who are very much, I don't want to call them like SJW type people, but you know what I mean? Like, they have more feelings than facts. So they see an injustice and they want to fix it. But their solution, like you said in the pre-show, is more horrorness, more horribleness, giving more authority and power to one person to be a complete dictator over their lives, as if that's going to be better than Batista. I mean, I understand the desire for change, obviously, and they probably correctly figure out some injustices, but the few injustices they say in the movie are like, well, this kid doesn't have what, food to eat, or this kid doesn't have shoes on his feet or whatever. And it's like, well, you have to give me a little bit more information in order for me to know that that's an injustice. I understand that from like the communist perspective, shoes exist, therefore everybody should have shoes. But from my view, just because someone doesn't have shoes doesn't mean that there's been an injustice. It doesn't mean that somebody's being oppressed. It just means that that person doesn't have shoes, and we can look into why he doesn't have shoes, but it doesn't automatically mean that there's an injustice that needs to be corrected. Whereas the characters in this movie are very much like, this character doesn't have shoes, we got to do something about that. And the solution, instead of buying the kid's shoes, is to institute an oligarchical dictatorial government over everybody to decide all the decisions for everybody's lives at gunpoint. That'll solve everything. Genius.
Right. But I mean, as we see, the rhetoric is always focused on some perceived problem that is obvious to everybody. And they don't come out and say, oh, we're going to take over in a totalitarian way and establish total control over you. They say, we're going to
liberation.
Right. Yeah. It's liberation. It's freedom. It's power to the people. We're going to take this back from this very corrupt and shitty government run by Batista, who's a fucking U.S. puppet, you know. And that sounds appealing. It's a great sales pitch. And people are, of course, going to support that. And you get enough people supporting it, and you get, you know, bad things that happen. Now, I don't know enough about the history of what was going on, but we see this in the film. You know, there's CIA operatives, that gourmet magazine guy. He's out there stirring trouble. He's a, you know, CIA, whatever they were called before they were the CIA.
OSS. Probably.
Yeah, OSS operative, keeping tabs on the Batista puppet government regime of Cuba in the U.S.'s favor. And of course, despite there being the OSS there, and despite there being all this money and arms being funneled into Batista's government, it wasn't enough to keep it as a stable regime. And so there was enough of a focus of resistance to galvanize the peasantry class to resist him and eventually overthrow him. And it seemed as if all it took was for him to leave the country and they won. You know,
yeah.
And in Godfather 2, Michael Corleone sees, and rightly so, that these people are willing to die for their cause, and the soldiers resisting it are being paid a wage, and that's why they're fighting. So obviously, you know, one side has more at stake, and one side is going to fight to the death and is willing to go that, you know, go beyond what the paid soldier, the mercenary, is going to go. And so absolutely, they have the ability to overcome the obstacle there.
Yeah. Not familiar, like you said, I'm not familiar either with the actual history. And I mean, in the movie, what Meyer Lansky claims, that the U.S. basically brought up Batista from what, being a shoe salesman or whatever it was, to being this dictator guy, and that he's been this puppet government leader dude for a long time. it basically seems like these people are kind of equivalent to like a Gandhi character, where they're sick of the imperial rule from outside, and they just want like a home ruler. They just want a Cuban for Cuba. And that is a very inspiring message for a Cuban who feels like they're being ruled from some other great power, for sure.
Right, right. Like, you think of Karzai. Wasn't he the guy in Afghanistan, or was he the Iraqi guy?
I think Karzai was in Afghanistan. I could be wrong.
Okay, yeah, and he was like a puppet, you know, U.S. puppet, and people resisted him. You see this all around in historical examples. And even the CIA guy, the Gourmet guy, at the end of the film, he says, oh, yeah, I'm heading off to Indochina. Well, what happens in Indochina after 1959? You know, you get Vietnam. And so that's probably also at least alluded to in the film. That was
probably going to hang out with Ho Chi Minh and funnel arms to that guy. And then back when Ho Chi Minh was an ally of the United States.
Right. And that's how these things always go. I mean, Dave Smith makes this point, like it's at the beginning of a show. It's a quip. And he says, you know, if you want to know who our next enemy is, look at who we're funding right now.
Yep.
And, you know, we see it with Saddam Hussein, we see it with all sorts of characters throughout history. And the flip-flopping and the sides taken on all this stuff is just amazing. And Scott Horton does a great job of disentangling that with his latest book, Enough Already. And there's a companion 13-part video series that that has been posted about that, covering each chapter. And it gets into the whole Middle East thing. And I know, I mean, we're talking about a movie, Havana, about Cuba, but you see the same things kind of playing out historically. And I can't recommend that book and that video series enough. So I'll post that on our show notes page, of course.
Yeah, for those people that seem to think that, yeah, you know, it's true that bad people do bad things, and obviously, but to not recognize the influence and the creation of enemies that the United States government does over and over and over and over again is just willfully ignorant at this point. So let's talk about this film here, Daniel. What did you think of the main character? He's like this kind of 50-year-old playboy guy who's just just interested in gambling. He doesn't really have a family. We don't know if he has a family at all. He's just looking for his next big score. He just loves to play cards. That's all he's all about. And he doesn't even care about politics. He's almost like, I don't know, he reminds me a lot of people that live around here where I live.
Yeah,
that they really just don't pay attention to what government people say. And that kind of warms my heart. They're just like, it has no effect on my life. I mean, it has effect on my life, but they're always going to be doing crap and trashy crap and garbage stuff.
Incrementally, and always getting worse.
Yeah. And what I can do really isn't going to be a positive out. You know, what can he do? And so he ends up getting involved in this revolution, which obviously led to horrible things. So is he not like the hero here, where he's like, I don't even want to get involved. This is dumb. I mean, I don't know. He doesn't make it pass moral judgment on it, but he's just like, I don't really know about it. I don't know enough about it. All I know is to keep my head down and stay out of trouble and do what I do. They let me do what I do, and I'll let them do what they do.
Yeah. I think that the Jack Wilde character, Robert Redford's character, he is very much in the same vein as the concept of Havana in Godfather 2, where it's like this place where, because of the regulations and things going on in the United States, you could still get away with things down in Havana. And so that's why you'd see all this gambling and the red light district and all of those things going on in this film. And it's like this hedonistic kind of mecca of sorts. And you're right. You know, the Jack Wilde character, he is sort of living autonomously, you know, for seeking pleasure and things like that. And he was, as a character, he was, he lived through Pearl Harbor. I guess he was there, stationed there. He was in World War II. And he, at that time, just decided that he wanted to pursue the, you know, the benefits of physical pleasure and things like that. So he got into gambling and he got really good at it, and wine, women, and song and all of that thing, and moving around from place to place where he could gamble and live it up. And I think that while it may not have been believable, especially to you, that he finds that this Lena Olin character, the Bobby character, has a certain je ne sais quoi that he finds an instant attraction to. And he maybe hasn't experienced that before. Like, you know, the two girls that he and the reporter guy go out on a date with, and he ends up having a threesome with them.
Yes.
They're nice, but they're kind of empty. You know, they're sort of empty vessels. They're like vapid. They're just there for a good time. They're there to party and whatever. And he's probably had a slew of women like that in all of these various locales. But then he finds this Bobby person who encounters him on the cruise ship and I guess can sort of like ferret out that he has some sort of confidence, probably due to his, you know, poker and gambling and things like that, that he has a certain suave about him, that she entrusts him with helping to get those radios smuggled in her vehicle through the ferry. And so he has a certain set of skills. Now, I'm a man of no particular skills, but the Robert Redford character in this has a certain set of skills, not Liam Neeson style, where he will hunt you down and find you, but as a way of, like, if not bumbling his way through something, bribing his way through something, or just through the sheer, you know, will of confidence or bluffing, getting what he wants. And so she sees him as a vehicle to get what she needs accomplished because she would otherwise not be able to do it. And she was under surveillance by, what are they, the MIS or the SIM, S-I-M, the Stasi of Batista's government.
Right.
And she's aware of this because, she's with the Raul Julia character, who is a big, prominent person in Cuba, but also happens to be sympathetic to the rebels, even though he's wealthy and has... you know, is generationally, like, his family has a, gives him a certain cachet and a certain amount of protection. Like, he even says, like, I'm at the level where I can't be tortured or I can't be killed or something like that. Of course, he's wrong. They do torture the shit out of him and they torture the shit out of his wife. But that gets him up to a certain point where he can sort of press forward with the rebels kind of like cause up to a point before it finally gets the ire of the Batista government and taking him in and torturing him, torturing his wife, making her think that he's dead. And that's another key component in the character's love story and interest. Like the Robert Redford character, he sees her, he meets her, and she's different than the slew of women he's had for the past 20 years because she has a cause. She's driven by something. And she has a head on her shoulders and all those things. So there's a certain attraction that he has for her, and she does not reciprocate that initially. But then he goes out of his way to get her sprung from the torture, from the secret, you know, police nabbing her and making her believe that her husband is dead. And then he's offering to her in his naivety that he will take her away to wherever they want to go, wherever in the world, get her away from Cuba, get her away from all of this, you know, danger and all of the things going on. And so she, in thinking that her husband's dead, is willing to go along with it. And that is kind of like where her and Robert Redford's stars align for a brief moment. But then he discovers that Raul Julie, her husband, is still alive. And so then he goes and makes a sacrifice a la Humphrey Bogart in Casablanca. This
how dare you mention this movie in the same breath as Casablanca?
It's basically
how
the same story.
How dare
man.
You? How dare you, sir?
It's a very similar story where it's this playboy, disinterested person who has a love interest but is otherwise apolitical about the whole thing, using his connections and his abilities to help reunite a man and wife.
Yeah, no, now that you say it, it's pretty much the exact same story, except just done way, way worse. let's remake Casablanca, but let's just do a way worse job about it. Is that what we're going for in this one? Okay, let's do it.
Now, I found that it was actually pretty good. I the Lena Olin character, that I thought that she was... there was a wide difference in after she was tortured, she looked very different than when she was being seductive on the ferry, trying to get him to help her. You know, she was being very playful and seductive And after she's tortured, her eyes are baggy, her hair's a mess. She looks like a totally different person. You know, and while you may have seen Wooden in that, I see like a Swedish person and their demeanor. Because she's, you know, she's from Sweden, right? So
Okay.
I found it believable that she would behave the way that she did. Like, whereas you found it kind of unbelievable. I found that she was not Wooden. I found that she was just, oh, she's from Sweden. So that's kind of how she is.
Swedish people, they're just impersonable and uninteresting. It's just how they are. This movie does, as bad as it is, does have some truth value in it. So Robert Redford plays this kind of empty vessel, carefree, floating along, not really. He's found his one thing that he's really interested in life, but things he doesn't understand, he doesn't, you know, have an opinion on, right? As opposed to so many other people in the world today, where they're like, I have no understanding of this, but I am an expert and I will tell you what I think.
Right. And you're evil if you disagree.
Exactly. And if you disagree, you're an evil racist. He's more like the, I don't feel qualified to decide who should be in charge, blah, 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 blah. It's very much an honest thing, which I appreciated about that. But you're right. He does run into this revolutionary lady who is passionate about something. It's passionate about something he doesn't quite understand, but he does recognize that fire in her is different than the other women that he is around. And from my own personal experience, I can say that is absolutely, there is a certain amount of value in that. Even though it's probably way more trouble than it's worth, there are women on these dating apps and in the world that are like very much social justice types, and they have a passion. They are all about BLM and social justice, and I mean, you name it, right? There's something attractive about that.
Really?
Even from my point of view.
Wow. Because I'm surprised. Least,
even because you will have great conversations with that person as long as they're open to you, listen to you. If they're not, then okay, forget about it. They're just interested in being right and whatever.
Or virtue signaling.
Right. But if they are open to listen to you and honestly want to understand your viewpoint, they, I think, give you more interesting feedback because there is that kind of clashing, you're exchanging ideas where you have very different ideas and you're trying to reach a common ground and trying to understand one another. And that is quite intellectually stimulating as opposed to someone you already agree with and there's nothing to talk about.
Okay. See where you're going with this. Yeah. Because they are most likely, I'm not saying all the time, but most likely just looking at one or two layers deep. Whereas when you have a conversation with them, you got to take them two, three, four layers deep to really, and it's unfortunate because it's like the bumper sticker versus the essay.
Yeah. Yeah. They're very much bumper sticker. And if you come at them with an essay, it's rare. You got to find someone that is interested in reading the essay, which is why you probably don't hit them with the full ANCAP message from the get-go. You get them to know you, understand that you're a good person first, and then you work it in. But at least you have a mind there that is passionate about something, and that is attractive. No matter what it's about, but social issues, even though I think they're pretty much wrong about everything, it does show that they are, you know, they're aware of the world. They're kind of taking on the traditionally, I hate to say it, man's role, but usually the man's role is to be aware of the world and be aware of threats and conditions so that they can protect their family unit against those things and adapt to current conditions and, you know, that kind of thing. Then this is the women coming in and kind of putting their own spin on things. And then being upset about microaggressions and mansplaining and manspreading and things like that. It's cute and it's kind of annoying, but it is, I think, it shows that there's a mind there that, you know, I can't quite put it into words, but there, I can see that there's something attractive about it. And I can see why Robert Redford in this movie is attracted to her, even though there is literally no scene in this movie where she does anything other than look pretty to him in order to engender the kind of head over heels romance and like crazy steps he takes to assist her in her goals.
Yeah, I think this is a supply and demand thing for Robert Redford's character, where he has seen so much supply of the vapid party girl, and then he sees somebody who's different, and that stands out to him. And so he has that love at first sight kind of thing based on her passion about something important to her and her directness in her approach to him.
Yeah, and how the market has spoken about this film and how nobody wanted to watch it and how it's not available to watch now. The market has spoken that this is a crap film and nobody cares. Nobody wants to see it. And they're right. There's a reason why Casablanca is a widely regarded masterpiece that is available pretty much anywhere. And Havana is something that you have to dig out of the trash to try and find. There's a reason why the market has spoken. People to serve the market. Whoever owns the rights to this film is trying to serve the market, but the problem is they've got way too much supply and not enough demand, so they hide it on Stars. You know, it's just what it is, right?
All right. Well, since you are saying the market has spoken, I will now introduce some Bob Wenzel commentary related to this film.
Sweet.
Now, I think that his point in bringing this up was, I think, the dynamic between the easy bumper sticker message of getting the masses ready to revolt versus the essay, you know, measured, like, here's what the actual solution would be in this scenario, and how we in the United States are now heading into socialism. And we've just had like a year of essentially the means of production being seized and controlled by the government. I mean, we are essentially a social state right now in many respects. But I digress, and I will go to the two articles that Bob Wenzel put on his Target Liberty site. One is shortly after Donald Trump was elected. It was posted Saturday, November 19th, 2016, and it is entitled, "Why Donald Trump Really Isn't My President." He says, "I don't get these lefty protesters who object to Donald Trump, but who voted and thus sanctioned the system. If Hillary had won, I wouldn't consider her my president either. And that's because I didn't vote. I don't support a system where the masses get to choose between two sociopaths. And I certainly don't support wailing because your sociopath didn't get in. I'm in favor of a private property society with no government power in charge, but we are far, far away from such a system. So my guiding principle in this day and age of madness comes via the Jack Weil character played by Robert Redford in the very underrated film Havana, who said, know who is in charge and how to stay out of trouble." So that's that first comment. And I think maybe that was why he was making the point to do this episode with us due to current events. And maybe that's around the coronavirus nonsense and you know, the Fauci emails have come out and basically like vindicated all of our misgivings about the guy and all of these things that have been going on for the last year, 14 months. But I think his point is look who's in charge and avoid getting on their radar. I think that's his point of this. Any commentary on that before we go to the next one?
Yeah, for sure. There's great value in being aware of what the tyrants are trying to do and counteracting accordingly. Whether that be, as you have mentioned in the past, becoming, what is it, like a borderless man? What is that term that you use? International man?
International sovereign man? Or, yeah, you diversify your physical location, your business's location, your financial location across different jurisdictions. You're basically a tourist everywhere you go, and they generally treat tourists better.
Right. And if you're in multiple places, they can't really lock you down. If your assets are in multiple different locations, if they seize one of them, you're not screwed. There's also value, you know, for sure you want to stay out of trouble in the sense that you don't want to call down the Eye of Sauron on you, because that is a fight you rarely win. What is the federal conviction rate, something like 99 point something percent. It's so corrupt and ridiculous.
It's the government using the government to prove the government was wronged.
Yeah. So, you know, what could go wrong there? Yeah. Keeping your head down. It's not keeping your head down also kind of looks a lot like just living your life. It's not necessarily that you're in hiding per se, but that you recognize that these people don't, they don't own you. They don't have any sovereignty over you. And you're just as, what am I trying to say? Nah, I had a thought and it's gone now. Never mind. I'll think of it later. Maybe, who knows? This is usually where I cut the guest. And
right,
then
guest,
the guest
bail him out.
Bail me out.
All right. Well, he will actually bail us out because his next post related to this film came out Wednesday, August 9th, 2017. This is when Google fired an employee who wrote like a thing against
the memo.
The memo, the social justice stuff.
No, he wasn't. He liked the women in tech memo.
Is that the one?
That was one big one. I don't remember the timeline exactly, but
well, this
there
is
was
the
guy,
James Damore guy.
Yeah. Yep. That's the women in tech guy. He was like, this is why women aren't in tech as much because okay. They have different interests, blah, blah, blah. And everybody was like, well, look at this screeching racist Nazi.
All right. People can't possibly have preferences.
There's no way. It's all due to systemic sexism. Why there aren't more women in tech. You know this.
All right. So this one came out Wednesday, August 9th, 2017. It's entitled Fired Google Employee James Damore is an Idiot.
Okay.
And it references a video by a guy named Lionel Nation. And I will put this on our show notes page, of course, at lastnerds.com/180. And it reads, Lionel Nation makes some very good points here. It brings to mind the wise comment made by the Robert Redford character Jack Weil in the very underrated movie Havana. Know who is in charge and how to stay out of trouble.
Is that how he always talks about it? It's how he always references this movie. It's always the wildly underrated film.
That's right. Okay. Wildly right. Underrated. Beautiful film. All right. Going back to the article. This doesn't mean you need to support wacko social justice warrior stuff, just that you need to know when it makes sense to keep your head down. It is really basic economics. There is a cost associated with lifting your head up when the cultural Marxists are patrolling. And sometimes it may make sense to do so, and other times it doesn't. So he's basically saying that James Damore stuck his head up into an issue that he knew would be thorny and would have repercussions. And he was foolish for choosing that battle. Continuing with Bob Wenzel, you can't die on every hill. The bastards need to be taken down. Just be smart about it. Remember, the heroic patriot Patrick Henry may have objected to the U.S. Constitution as being too federalist and that it endangered some freedoms, and he may have earlier on said, quote, give me liberty or give me death, end quote. But he died an old man, retired on a farm of 520 acres.
Yeah. I mean, there's some wisdom in that, what he said, but I do appreciate the James Damores of the world that throw themselves on the barbed wire that get the conversation going because
he's the guy in Godfather 2 willing to die for the revolution.
He is. He's a soldier in the war and he's not necessarily, he's had enough and he's willing to die on this hill. Now, Bob is also right in that you are sort of just kind of committed suicide here, but man, what if nobody ever sticks their head up? We just let these people rule us? Fuck yeah. That. I'm not going to be ruled by some social justice busybody nitwit. Who wants to live under that kind of tyranny?
No, and it's even worse now with the COVID stuff. You know, and
who wants to be ruled by the Karens of the world? Not me.
Yeah. So you do need some people to stand up and, I recall a video, I may have shared it with you a few years ago, and we probably talked about it on a perhaps previous version of our podcast, but it's the guy dancing at a concert at the Gorge in George Washington. And at first, he's just some random guy dancing. And people are kind of laughing at him. and making note of him, but you know, they're not willing to get in on it. And then a few people start to join in, and then a few more, and then a few more. And eventually you have like a dozen people up dancing. And then all of a sudden the gates go wide open and everyone in this area in the video comes out to dance. And it literally is like this groupthink mentality where you need some pioneers blazing a trail to show that something's okay. And that it's something is not stupid to do, that something is, you don't need to care if you look silly or whatever. And you go against the convention, right? And eventually you get this tipping point where then it becomes acceptable by the masses. And I think that in modern day times, and this might be related to a Bob Wenzel point, he always confronted people who would demand that he wear a mask. And he lived in San Francisco, which was a very heavy mask mandated, highly regulated, highly over responding to the COVID nonsense. And he would challenge these people. One of his points was that he was willing to do the white lie, to say he had a medical condition or whatever, to get them to back off, you know, to force them to raise the stakes, right? And he called them the mini Maos. These are people who got a taste of power due to the circumstance, and they didn't want to give up that taste of power, but that he found that most of them would back down after being challenged just once or twice.
Yeah, they are the bullies that believe they have the social backing to right. bully everybody else.
Right.
And anybody they see that they think is out of line.
Right. And then going back to that dancing thing, I think that similarly, and especially now that it's been admitted in the Fauci emails, that even Fauci himself had said that these drugstore masks that you buy aren't really effective and they're only...
good at protecting people that are already sick and then maybe going to stop a droplet or something. Yeah.
Right. So he basically admits that he lied and he's done this so many times, but the point is that now, and you probably for even longer than me have been more and more able to normalize a bare face, you know, and the more people that see other people out there with a bare face, it would become more and more acceptable again.
Absolutely. 100%. Yeah. And the more and more James Damores of the world who can show you that it's okay to challenge this just beyond stupid thinking that, I mean, this is from the crowd. I mean, what he was saying was so blatantly obvious. And then he got thrown under the bus by these screeching harpies who say, "How dare you? Men and women are exactly the same. And the only reason women don't like to go into STEM is because they're held down by the patriarchy." And he's like, no. Men and women have different preferences. Women like to go into social things. They like to be teachers. They like to be caregivers. Men
like to. I think he even said in generalities. He didn't say every woman. He said generally.
He's like, these are the numbers. These are men are just generally more interested in stuff. And women are generally more interested in people. And that's just the way our bodies and biology works. But the science denying left who don't believe in biology anymore screeched that he's this evil Nazi and he must be destroyed because he's a heretic to the orthodoxy.
Right. And they believe in scientism, unfortunately, and they call it science. And we see it today where they believe in the high priest of science TM who, you know, whose emails have just recently come out, and they're throwing cover for him. It's amazing. Tom Woods came out with an email just today, and he's going to have an episode out tomorrow, and it'll be out before this episode. So I'll put on a show notes link, lastnight.com/180, because he's going to go through the creme de la creme of Fauci's emails and where he admits something privately that he doesn't say publicly. He's like Hillary Clinton, where she has a thing she'll say privately and a thing she'll say publicly.
Oops, I said the silent thing out loud. Oops.
Exactly. What the fuck was my point? So anyway, the Tom Woods thing will come out. The Fauci emails are going to be discussed. In the email today, he says that somebody measured how much coverage this was given on the various media networks.
Oh, yeah.
And on Fox News, it was like discussed 128 times over the course of 3 hours in a 24-hour period. On NBC, it was mentioned 3 times for a total amount of like 3 minutes, something like that. And on MSNBC, I might be wrong about it. I'm making it up a little bit. But it was mentioned 1 time for 5 seconds.
Yeah, I think there was like a BuzzFeed article or something like that that said, oh, Fauci, these emails reveal how much pressure there was on him.
Yeah.
And then that's all you got to say about
it. The martyr.
That's all you got to say? There's nothing else of interest in those emails that is worth mentioning? No, just too much pressure on this one guy. That's the real story here.
How could he possibly have been like totally right every time?
That's an impossible standard to live up to. How dare you?
Right. But the hilarity ensues every time you listen to anything, any segment of him speaking for more than a minute. He will contradict himself within the very same minute. And yet whatever he utters is deemed the science.
Yeah. Yeah. I know it's really bad. The fact that the science has gotten so political is really disgusting. There should be more and more people calling it out from all sides, from everywhere, that this guy is full of shit, and that the fact that anybody listened to him and took him too seriously is a disaster. A whole lot of policy was generated by what this asshole said. I'm not saying that anybody should listen to what any of the governors said anyway, but to say that his statements as an expert didn't carry a whole lot of weight with them is absolutely willful ignorance. Whatever he said was basically taken and run with by the left in the mainstream media.
And selectively cherry-picked.
Right, absolutely cherry-picked to suit the narrative, and then crafted into policy by the governors and willfully went along with by the Karens and the virtue signalers, and then even the willing or the unwilling, you know, the people that just the go along, get along people.
You know, I was one of those for a while. I would wear a bandana to not be confronted.
Right. No, I totally understand that. And a lot of people did that. A lot of people did that.
I no longer do it because it's become obvious that it's you need those people out dancing.
Yeah. Absolutely. You gotta show courage so that everybody else can see the way. You gotta shine the light. You gotta be the candle in the dark.
That's right. And actually that brings me to another point after I make this point. This is not a new thing related to science, TM, being corrupted by government. Murray Rothbard wrote about this, I think in the 1950s. There was a book he wrote called Science, Technology, and Government. And you can find this on our show notes page, lastnight.com/180. And it was just released just a few years ago. It was a manuscript that he'd written in 1958 or something like that, roughly around the time that this movie was based. And it talks about the corrupting influence of having government involved in science at all, and grants and funding and things of that nature. And of course, you're going to have certain things bend a certain way based on where the funding's coming from, right? And he saw this 50 years ago. I mean, and we only see now just how obviously blatantly fucked up that whole situation is. But also, of course, it's very selectively outraged. Like, two different people can see things in totally different ways these days. It's like we're almost two separate nations forced to live together, right? The left and the progressives will see something and see nothing untoward with anything that Fauci has done. Whereas people on the right or people of thinking means will see, well, this man contradicts himself all the time. He lies and admits to lying for ends, for trying to manipulate behavior. That should disqualify him immediately. He did that 6 months ago where he said, oh, yeah, I said, don't buy up masks because I wanted to save them for the medical personnel. I didn't want to have them be all purchased, bought up by people in a panic. You know, that was him admitting a lie right there. And then later on, he had said something along the lines of, we need 60% or 70% vaccination rate or herd immunity. And then he later on changed that to a higher number. And he admitted later to changing that number, not based on science, but based on trying to manipulate behavior. And now the emails come out, which you know has much more to bear, obviously.
Well, and that just endears him to the society controlling left people,
right? Because he's doing it for a noble cause,
right? Yeah, it doesn't matter. The ends justify the means. He was doing it because he wanted a good outcome. And so, what if you got to lie to you know get people to do what
trick
you want?
Those dummies. Trick those stupid those, Trump supporters.
Those hillbilly rubes. They need to be lied to. They're not gonna listen to the truth. So yeah, absolutely. He's a wonderful, wonderful man.
Yeah. All right. So my second point was you brought up the candles in the dark thing. And Lark and Rose, we went to the candles in the dark together, you and I. And in fact, our much of our logos and art is based on a photo we took there. But one of the points was brought up in a Q&A session where somebody said something along the lines of, well, what if we just stopped paying taxes? And of course, if only a few people do it, they'll come down on you. But at some point, there will be enough people not doing it to where they will be powerless to do anything about it. But unfortunately, and he was a victim of this, he actually went to prison, I think, for at least a year, maybe more, due to making arguments. And these were sound arguments as far as the legalities go, of he was not required to report this income due to Fourth Amendment violations or something along those lines. I don't know enough about it to really speak to it, but he wrote a whole book about it. I forget the name of the book. Do you happen to know? I'll post it on the show notes page, of course.
No, it's not
something about the dragon.
Yeah, that sounds something like that.
Yeah, you know what? Let me see. Rose Dragon. Kicking the Dragon. Yes. Kicking the Dragon is his book about his fight against the government regarding paying taxes and the sound legal grounds that he had, but he was still convicted and spent over a year in jail, where he wrote The Most Dangerous Superstition and or The Iron Web, which are both really good.
Yes, I highly recommend anybody that hasn't read Most Dangerous Superstition. I have a copy of The Iron Web. I haven't read it yet, but Most Dangerous Superstition is definitely excellent. A bit repetitive. You get it. It's a lot like Atlas Shrugged in that sense, but still quite good.
Like you get it in chapter 1 and 2, and then there's like 9 more chapters.
There's 9 more chapters, and they're just like variations on the theme. And they're like, yeah, okay, I can apply it this way. Yep, I already get it. Yep, but it's still... there's still nuggets to be had throughout. So I highly recommend the whole thing.
All right. So let's wind this back to the movie a little bit. I feel like I've sort of presented some of Bob Wenzel's points. You know, one is know who's in charge and know how to get out of their way, but also know when to challenge and when to inspire others to do the same, to normalize freedom. And also that the goal, of course, is a private property society. And that Trump was a lightning rod for basically becoming a common enemy for the various factions of the left. And that was a misstep, politically speaking, as far as staving off future socialist expansion into political acceptability.
Right. Okay, those are your points. I will counter as to why this is a garbage movie. With what did the main character do that affected the plot?
What did the main character do? Well, he got Lena Olin out of the torture murder prison. He bought the freedom of Raul Julia's character to reunite them, and inadvertently helped the cause of the revolution and the communist takeover of Cuba.
Exactly. He helped
further enslaving the population.
Further enslaving the population of Cuba for decades to come.
Which is why they still have the old cars like we see in the movie and in the background on the YouTube video here.
Robert Redford's character is a villain who oppressed the people of Cuba. And he's the bad guy.
We haven't even got the Che Guevara, the t-shirt icon.
He wasn't in this movie, was he?
No, as far as I... Well, maybe. There was the passing by of the military personnel from the rebels. when he was driving out to the finca, the ranch house.
And there was that dirty guy who busted into the house. Was that him?
It could have been a Che-type inspired character.
Yeah.
And it is Pride Month, and unfortunately, Che was not a fan of people of being celebrated in the month of June, and he murdered several of them. However, he is still a darling of the left.
Because his crimes mostly go ignored.
Yes.
And willfully ignored. I don't think that there's a whole lot of historical curiosity among the left to really learn about the guy too much. I think he's just...
Well, unless there's an atrocity committed by the Western cultures and white persons. Like, apparently there was a Tulsa massacre that has become important to the left in recent weeks that happened 100 years ago or longer ago that they weren't even aware of 3-4 weeks ago. And right now, it's, of course, an outrage.
For sure. Yeah, I remember that was a big thing when that Watchmen series came out. Mm-hmm. That was a couple of years ago, because they have a scene in that was about the Tulsa massacre.
Yeah. So that was the reintroducing it into the cultural zeitgeist. And that is what outraged people.
Okay. Sure. There's always something to get outraged about.
Yeah, which is the point that Bob Wenzel makes related to this movie and how the bumper sticker slogans are easy to stand to post and people get behind it. You know, it's easy to get people into something because it's emotionally charged and shallow thinking.
Right, which is why the whole George Floyd thing took off like gangbusters.
Mm-hmm.
It was quite easy. It was, you had the video. It was edited in a way that it looked really, really bad. And there are still a whole lot of people who cheered on everything that happened to. I mean, I'm not hugely sympathetic to the cop, but the idea that he was premeditated murder or whatever that was hilarious. Okay.
Yeah. I mean, he might have done something he shouldn't have done, but he wasn't like, I'm going to go find this guy and kill him.
Right.
Yeah. And to the other point, and we've made this point many times in the past, but the AOCs and the Bernie Sanders of the world, they'll often diagnose the symptoms of a problem correctly and be correctly outraged by it. Unfortunately, their solutions are 9 times out of 10 more of the same thing that caused the problem to begin with.
Yeah.
Yet they get people excited about it and clamoring for them to be empowered to do something about it, and which will, of course, exacerbate the very problem that they are pointing out as a failure of capitalism.
Well, and really seemed to come, at least from the left, from what I saw. I mean, maybe a few people mentioned it, but that the whole confrontation between George Floyd and the cops was over the counterfeiting of the $20 bill.
Which the Federal Reserve does every day, all day long.
Which the Federal Reserve is like their modus operandi, that's all they do. But they don't talk about, you know, the laws that cause cops to come into confrontation with people. Like all the excuses. Yeah. Right. I mean, if you had cops that were just like these night watchman people that were just there to protect private property. They weren't there to enforce all these ridiculous laws that politicians think up and whatever, like one person dies in a storm drain or whatever. And so then there's a movement to make sure storm drains are a certain regulated size and blah, 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 blah. And then a politician gets to get up on a soapbox and talk about the dangers of storm drains and how they need to be a certain way and how these evil storm drain manufacturers just aren't doing it right or whatever. We need to make a law.
They just want to make drains, a buck.
They just want to make a buck. They don't want to save people's lives. These callous people that are just profiting off of the death of these poor kids or whatever. And, you know, people need to talk about the reasons why cops interact with people. And that this doesn't come up. The left is always in favor of just one more law will save us. One more law will protect us. Just one more thing. It's always just, we're just always one thing away from paradise, and it's ridiculous and it's infantile thinking.
Yeah. Anyway. All right. And I want to correct a misstep that I made earlier where I was talking about the cars in the background and in the film. That isn't necessarily because of socialism. It's actually because of sanctions by the US. Whereas if those sanctions weren't there, it is possible that newer vehicles would be available for sale in Cuba. Now, it's not,
it was the embargo that didn't
resources to buy them, but it would be possible. Whereas now, or at least until Obama, I think he changed something in his last year or two in office where the sanctions were diminished. But like, you can't even like before that, or maybe even now, I don't even know. But like Cuban cigars were illegal. Like if you couldn't buy Cuban cigars, you couldn't bring them across the border. It was contraband to have them. It's, talk about fucking ridiculous, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And it made them highly sought after. And they're status
symbols. Anytime you make something illegal, it makes it scarce. It makes it rare. Makes it valuable.
Yeah.
Maybe they should figure that out.
They know it. They know it.
Yeah. Maybe they have figured it out. And that's, yeah. You know, I'm convinced that the drug war is purposefully pursued so that you can violate all the amendments of the Bill of Rights, have the surveillance state, and have, well, of course they needed to up the ante, right? They needed to take it up a notch. Bam! Take it up a notch with the war on terror internationally. And now they're kicking it up another notch to where people like you and I might be under the eye of Sauron simply for disagreeing with the mainstream left narrative.
Yeah. Yeah, good times. It's a wild time to be alive.
May you live in interesting times. I'm afraid that we do. Anyway, we've been going pretty long. Any other points you want to make about the movie before we get into your final summary and review? And I hope that I have increased at least a little marginally your score on this one.
Well, just because you can have a good conversation about a movie doesn't mean it's a good movie. You can talk about a turd all day long, talking about the little folds,
polish
and the wrinkles,
put lipstick on it.
You can do all kinds of things. You could admire the sheen and the texture. You can do all kinds of this doesn't change the fact that it's a garbage pile of a movie. You're right that it is just a retelling of Casablanca, but it's done with less charismatic leads, done with a far worse script. There wasn't a single time where I laughed, smiled, cried. There wasn't anything like that. And in a movie where this is like about, you know, it's a love triangle sort of thing where this guy finds the love of his life and he doesn't get to be with her. What kind of hack screenwriter and whatever director and actors can't make something heartfelt about that? It felt so flat. The movie's just at no point where did I even care if they got together or not. I didn't care if they escaped. I didn't care if they, when Robert Redford was driving up to the military, he's out in the countryside and like these military trucks were coming at him. And I thought that they were just going to turn around and shoot him. And I was kind of hoping for it. And then there was another scene when he's got the girl with him in the car and they're getting strafed by airplanes. And I'm like, that's good. Time to end the movie. Let's take him out. It would make no sense narratively, but just put this thing out of its misery. Come on. So this movie, I can't recommend it. I don't know why Bob thinks it's so great. I appreciate that he finds some philosophical themes in the main lead character, that his kind of view on the world has some wisdom to it. I do appreciate that. And, you know, we can talk about the Cuban Revolution and communism and why it's bad all day long. So there's some value there. And then I also appreciate the poker playing aspect of it. That was kind of fun for me as a fellow poker player, not a professional poker player, but I've played poker for money many, many times. Not for the stakes that he was playing at, but the ability for him to read a person and read a politician, and how he said that politicians don't understand why you may want to lose a hand so that you can win a bigger hand later, where they just want power all the time. They're very simplistic thinkers. That was kind of fun how easy they were to beat for him. That's a nice little insight into humanity.
Yeah, and the MIS guy wasn't like that.
Right. So
he was almost his equal.
There's some good stuff in the movie, but since the heart of the film is the romance, and it didn't work for me at all, I can't recommend the movie. I'm going to give this movie like a 3 out of 10. 3 Cuban cigars out of 10. So not.
Wow. Not 3 Habanas out of 10. That's terrible, man.
Yeah. It's not, a good movie. Watch Casablanca instead. Watch Casablanca like 3 times in a row instead.
Were you considering a lower score than 3 prior to our conversation, or was it no effect on your score?
If I took into account the things that engendered conversation about, I'd probably bump it up to a 4 or a 5. But I'm not recommending this film to other podcasters that want to watch this movie and then talk about it. I'm recommending this movie to people, just regular people that want to watch a film to get entertained by it. And I, since I was not entertained by this thing at all, I found, you know, Redford to be flat, uninteresting. His the female lead to be even worse. It was just a slog to get through it. And it's like overly long. It's like 2.5 hours long.
Right.
It's like, yeah. what are you doing for 2.5 hours? This movie could be wrapped up in 90 minutes and it's maybe slightly better.
Like Desperado, have some grenades going off down in the alley below.
Have some slow motion explosions. You can walk away coolly.
And some Saul Hayek, man.
Why not? I mean, at one point he like gets a gun from the 2 Secret Service agent guys. One guy could like throw it. He threw it off the boat. He could have like leaned off, caught the gun, popped them both in the head, and then did some like John Woo shit and like some doves flying off in the background.
Yeah, like John Wick style. Yeah.
I'd have it better.
Yeah, I mean, that's a scene that was worthy of discussion as well, as was the poker stuff. And I was thinking that it was going to come up before the very end here. So maybe we'll do that in some of the Kathleen Turner Overdrive bonus content available for our Patreon supporters at lastnighters.com/Patreon, on which we will also have Mike C. of Mechanical Dream Revolution, a 14-time guest,
where he will tell me how wrong I am the whole time.
He has an appreciation for this film. And so we will be doing that in the KTO. But before we get to that, I will do my final summary review. And I will give this a score out of a number of Habanas, not in an intern in the White House, obviously. That's an old joke. It's very dated. But I do have a blue dress. But I found this movie to be actually pretty well done. It's beautifully shot. It's well crafted. I thought that Robert Redford and Lena Olin were fine lead actors. Alan Arkin was, of course, great. Raul Julia was great. And he was uncredited because he wanted top line billing. But due to some contractual things with the studio, he was not going to be able to get that. And so he opted to not be credited at all. So you will not find his name anywhere in the credits on this film, even though he's in it for a fair amount as a supporting actor. So, and I think he did a fine job. But I think that this movie has some really good points that are brought up, mostly for discussion. And I like the retelling of Casablanca with the narrative of Godfather 1.5 in the background. I find it to be a pretty good movie, and I give it an 8 Habanas out of 10. So smoke that, Robert.
I definitely think you are smoking something. To give this turd an 8 out of 10 is on the level of something that should be illegal. There should be some law. Maybe Inslee can come up with something. He's a genius. Jay Inslee is a political genius, and he, of all people, could come up with some kind of law that would create justice out of the crime that just happened.
You know, the sad thing about democracy is that most people in this state agree with the guy and applaud him for his service and think he is, in fact, doing a great job when he is actually an inept, babbling idiot, in my humble opinion.
Yeah, no. Well, I completely agree with you on that one. You are not wrong. You are wrong about this film, but you are not wrong in your assessment of that smiling jackass.
Right. But unfortunately, I mean, this is why democracy does not work, because you can get enough people, the majority of people, ginned up on surface level, 1 or 2 layer deep outrage, and get them to do whatever you want. Whereas it, you know, it's the bumper sticker versus the essay. And that's essentially what you're dealing with in the political realm. And so it's always tilted in favor of encroachment and expansion of power.
It is. All right. Did we do this one justice? I don't know. I think Bob would have had some genius nuggets to throw at me, but overall, I think we did okay.
Yeah, I hope we did okay. Bob Wenzel, if you can see this, I hope that we did all right. I know that you would have had far more insightful things to say, but I tried to represent some of your opinions that I'm aware of about private property society, the Minnie Mouse, the Trump versus Hillary, and the ability to grow socialism as a result of having the common enemy, and that the ideal state is a non-political private property society. And as long as these sites are still up, I highly recommend that people go and just go through the archives, read the books that he's written. He has two or three books. One is called The Fed Flunks, and the other is A Private Property Society. And we'll, of course, have them on the show notes page. But go to economicpolicyjournal.com and also targetliberty.com and read some of his, you know, his past stuff. They're really short articles. They're hot takes on current events at the time. He'd post three or four things a day. Tom Woods was an avid reader. Walter Block was an avid reader and correspondent with him. He would often post responses from Walter Block or Tom Woods on his posts. And he was an all-around good guy, a strong advocate for freedom and Austrian economics. And we are lessened by his loss, by the loss of having him still out there. In reading him, I always thought that I would read him for the next decade or two, and that he would just continue to do what he does and just become this crotchety old curmudgeon guy and, you know, just keep on trucking and just keep on, you know, turning out the work. And I'm kind of blown away that he's not doing that right now. You know, he's not there anymore. And it was out of the blue. Tom Wood said that he died in his sleep and there was no preceding condition that precipitated this. It was just, it was his time, and that was it. And it's really unfortunate. He upon my invitation to have him come on for not this movie, but actually a different movie, and then he suggested this one. Open Secrets was an article that he had posted on his website, and I commented, and I was like, oh, that sounds like a great movie for us to discuss with you. Would you be willing to come on? And he wrote back and said, yeah, that'd be great, but I think Havana would be a better and more timely film to do. And we corresponded a few more times, and Open Secrets was still on the table as doing, and so was a movie called Mr. Jones, which was about the New York Times covering for the atrocities in the Soviet Union in the 1930s. And we were basically going to be doing a three or four movie set with him, and this would have been the first, and unfortunately none of those are going to happen. So we will, of course, do those movies. And this one, we held space for him. We held the chair open for him as a sort of tribute or honorarium. The other movies, we will have guests on and discuss them, and we will reference what we think that Bob Wenzel's points might have been related to them, because they were on his radar for being willing to do it. And I was blown away that he was so open to coming on this half-assed show that we do. And being excited about it and wanting to do more than just one. So anyway, Robert, why don't you I'm tearing up a little bit. Tell the audience what they win if they support us and how they can do that.
Oh, you win all the virtual hugs and thanks and gratitudes from us. And we just want to thank you for listening to this episode, this first duo episode in quite some time. Hopefully the ghost of Bob isn't too upset about our treatment of his film and my take on it, especially. I didn't particularly find it very good, but that's the beauty of art, is that other people can find fantastic things to talk about and to be fascinated by things that just pass other people right by. And that's that's why I keep, I kind of find a lot of doing this show a lot of fun. And I'm glad. I mean, it makes me happy and excited when I hate something and other people really like it, or vice versa. But especially when I hate something and other people really like it, that's probably, because then you get to find, hear some newfound appreciation for something. And I wasn't necessarily convinced tonight. Maybe if Bob had been on, he would have maybe convinced me a little bit more. But life comes in and suddenly rips things away from you, and that's why it's most important to let people know that are in your life that you love them and you care about them, and that you value their presence and their ideas and their thoughts and all the wonderful things that they do for you and for others. And that's how you can support us right now, is just to appreciate the people you have in your life and to let them know that you appreciate them. Okay.
All right. Well, well said, Robert.
You never know. You never know when they're going to be, say they're going to be on a podcast and then they die to get out of having to do it. You never know when that's going to happen.
Well, hopefully this does not ever happen again. Now, we have done another episode in honor of a past guest. We did Brazil. This is probably 2-3 years ago with a suggestion by Lewis Lieberman, who wanted to do an episode with us on that. And he died. And then we did an episode in honor of him. But let's not make a habit of this. Please, people who are going to be a guest, don't die for a long time. Please. Just
concentrate
on
living.
Concentrate on
living. Living, breathing. Keep doing that over and over and over again. I know it gets tiresome. Keep everything. But you just got to keep doing it.
Right. Give you something to look forward to, your next appearance on our show. And speaking of our next appearance, Ben Johnson, who was our guest for Gentlemen Broncos like a year ago, he's coming back. And Ben, you better come back next week. We're going to be doing a movie you've suggested called Law Abiding Citizen, starring Gerard Butler and Jamie Foxx. Apparently, we're in a rut of Jamie Foxx movies. He was starring a co-star in one of our recent films that we just did, Jarhead, with the Why I Am Anti-War podcast, Scott Spaulding, which I felt was a very good Memorial Day episode. And that's the one that we did just before this one. So we're going to be doing Law Abiding Citizen next week, and it should be a lot of fun with our buddy Ben Johnson, who was on for the movie that Robert did not review with us on the episode, but did so in a bonus content, Gentlemen Broncos, of Napoleon Dynamite director fame, Jerusha and what's the other guy's name? Jared and Jerusha Hess. That's right.
Wow. Sometimes you know stuff, and I'm just impressed.
Apparently, some of it sticks. All right.
Nice.
So we're going to get into some Kathleen Turner Overdrive bonus content with our buddy Mike C. of Mechanical Dream Revolution. You can check out his latest work at mechanicaldreamrevolution.com. He's been a 14-time guest, and he's going to give us our take on this movie, Havana, in the Kathleen Turner Overdrive, available for Patreon supporters. Go to lastnighters.com/Patreon. Support us with whatever Federal Reserve note denomination of your choosing, and you will get bonus content from us. And we look forward to having you join us for that, because that means that we get some moolah, and also you get extra content. So anyway, it's a great deal. It's a good deal. Check it out. lastnighters.com/Patreon. Anyway, join us next week for The Law Abiding Citizen with Ben Johnson, and we will see you guys all next week. And I will say goodnight from last night, everyone. Peace out and maximum freedom. All right, and before we get into that Kathleen Turner Overdrive, we have a few more moments on the Actual Anarchy podcast. You find the show notes and more for this one at actualanarchy.com/237. We'll have a bunch of links on this one related to Bob Wenzel's websites, his books, and other things that we've mentioned on the show. But Robert, I wanted to give you an opportunity, and I thought that this would happen earlier, to talk about the poker aspect, the poker angle, as related to this film, because Robert Redford's character is a bit of a poker shark. Who is highly skilled, has strong confidence, is willing to lose a hand to win a bigger hand later. He bluffs. All of these things, these nuances that go along with the game of poker, and I know that you are a player of sorts, and so you have some awareness of this. I myself am terrible at poker, even though I try to be analytical and try to do these things to, you know, sometimes I'll bluff, sometimes I'll blow a hand on purpose, but I always end up losing. What's your take on the poker angle in this film?
Well, he did say a few things that were interesting. I mean, it's very, I think, accurate to the kind of high stakes gambler poker player and the psychology of it, that where he believes he plays the game so well that he isn't really gambling that much. He is got it figured out, where he is not just he's not really playing cards. And most gamblers, I think high stakes poker players would understand this, or this is their philosophy. You're not playing poker. You are playing the other players. So you, it doesn't really matter what the cards are. You are reading your opponent and acting accordingly. That's generally the high level of play we're talking about. The games that they were playing, like straight draw, I think he called it at one point. And another time he called it like Canadian draw. This was back before Hold'em really became popular. This was more of a stud kind of game, which is still played, but it's not nearly as popular. This is where there are no common cards that everybody shares. You're just, you have your hand, and maybe you expose some of those cards in your hand, but other cards you keep hidden. It's still a good game. I've played it a little bit, but I really got into Hold'em like in like 2001 or 2002 when Chris Moneymaker was televised on
the World Series of Poker stuff.
The World Series of Poker. And I got into that pretty good. I mean, I was like kind of a late adopter. My sister and my father really got into it, and they kind of had like a little bit of a bonding over it. Like they would talk about different poker players and who was their favorite and that kind of thing. And then a few years later, I started watching it and kind of getting into it. And I understood how fascinating it was and the decisions that these people make, where they are, you know, literally throwing millions of dollars on one hand, the kind of gambling that goes into this. But that's the risk reward you have to take in order to play at this level. You have to be willing to risk it all in order to be successful. It's got to just be a numbers game for you. And you got to remember the hands, but you got to disassociate from any kind of emotion attached to it. So you just lost $1 million. Most people would be pulling their hair out, crying their eyeballs and running away. But for a professional poker player, they're like, okay, deal the next hand. Let's go.
Right. And we saw this in that, what was that movie we did? That lady poker player. Shit, what was it called?
Oh, yeah. She was a skier, and then she ran a poker game.
Yeah.
And then the cops or the feds busted her for not paying taxes or whatever it was.
Yeah, we did an episode on it, and I can't tell you the fucking name of it.
Yeah, she was like, yeah, I forget.
And a lot of this stuff that you're talking about is also in Casino Royale, the first Daniel Craig Bond against Mads Mikkelsen.
Yeah, and then there's some of that in also in the Rounders. Chief. There's been a few good poker movies. Probably Rounders is probably the best, but there's been a few that explore the game. It's really quite a fascinating psychological game.
Yeah, because you know, it's not really so much the Rain Man like counting the cards stuff necessarily. It's more like you're saying, once you're at a certain level, you're into the psychological. Like everyone's sort of on the at a certain level, everyone's on the same like mechanical, mathematical level. And then it's down to the person and the tells and the psychology of it.
Right. Yeah. Everybody knows the book. And everybody knows, right, like you've got a 12% chance to win with your cards. You got two cards to hit. You know the odds. You've got $500,000 you can win in this hand. You've got a 12% chance to win it. Do you fold?
And just
do
to
you
get
raise?
To that
you
level,
do?
You got to be like fucking knowledgeable.
Oh, yeah. You got to watch poker. You got to read books. You got to learn. You got to play it a whole lot just to get to that level. But then there's the psychological level where you know you're reading your opponent. You're talking to them. They're giving you information whether they want to or not. You remember what they've done on past hands. It's a memory game where I played a hand with this guy 52 hands ago. And what did he do on the turn? Oh, yeah, he raised me when, you know, you remember these things.
And that's how you know that Robert Redford's character is a high-level player, because he's willing to throw hands to fuck that up.
And he talked about how he remembered pretty much every hand he's ever played. And mm-hmm. and that's exaggerating it a little bit, but I can almost guarantee you if you're not going like some crazy, like binging 24-hour, 48-hour, 72-hour poker playing session, if you play a few hundred hands and then you took a quiz the next day on those hands, I bet you'd get most of the questions right like, what was the card that came out after that card, and what were you holding at that time, and then what did your opponent end up showing? Those little details. It's like somebody who, you know, like a Scott Horton who knows everything about the wars, or somebody who knows everything about baseball stats or whatever.
Or it's chess just moves like a Bobby Fischer.
Right, you're just so into it, and it's every little detail is so important. So of course you're just going to naturally remember it. You may not remember your girlfriend's birthday, but you remember that the guy was holding the Jack 4 offsuit when he raised and bluffed you on the return when the King of Hearts came out. You remember that.
Right. I know that my wife and my anniversary is coming up, but we make a joke that we don't know like which date it actually is. I mean, I actually do know, but I play along.
Nice. You play along.
Yeah. But it's our 10 year coming up.
Wow. Wow. What is that? Is that the diamond? Is that the
no, it's crystal. Tin. It's tin.
Tin. That doesn't sound very special. Get the fuck out of here with your dumbass tin.
I looked it up, man. I looked it up. It's tin.
All right. So what do you do? What do you got to do? You got to get her some,
well, I can't. She listens to the show, my man. I can't divulge.
She get her a case of Fresca.
I get her some fucking sardines.
Nice. Perfect. She loves it.
Yeah. Anyway, we should wrap this up so we can get to Kathleen Turner Overdrive, available for Patreon supporters, where we're going to get a take from Mike C. of Mechanical Dream Revolution on this movie, Havana, because he actually says he likes it a lot and sees a lot of meaning in it. And so he's going to rake you over the coals, my man.
Perfect. Can't wait.
All right.
Let's
do it. So people, give us likes and subscribes. Give us money at Patreon. Go to actualanarchy.com/Patreon. Also, buy things on our links. Go to actualanarchy.com/237 to find the show notes page, and also the various Amazon links to the Bob Wenzel books and other things, other such sundries. You can also go to Trubster.com and buy merch designed by my co-host, 99.44% Ivory, Robert Paul Johnson, the great Ivory Hope, or Rope-a-Dope Soap. Nope, I don't know. And I'm fucking rhyming. I think I've had too much gin and tonic tonight. But anyway, join us next week for what's called
Law Abiding Citizen.
That's right. Law Abiding Citizen with Bob. Ben Johnson. What? That's right. What? You're Bob.
No.
Man, falling off the fucking rails tonight. All right. ActualAnarchy.com says 237. We'll see you guys all next week. And peace out. Maximum freedom, everyone.
Bye.
See you next. Bye.
Chipmunks. Chipmunk. We're the chipmunks. Guaranteed to brighten your day. Doot, doot. Doot, doot, doot. Doot, doot, doot.